Blog Talk Radio.
The duty of a civilized person who is a member of the Five Ten Nations is to teach civilization to what? Uncivilized.
Peace to the God.
Peace to law.
Hey, yo, there go that brother's wearing Pooh Bah. Heard that brother got nauseous.
Yo, you and G, brother. Yo, let's have that brother come over and add on to the site.
I guess I'm like the verbalize, I hold the back of moving blackwards. This Asiatic black man is a dog fell backwards. The maker, the owner, the cream of the planet Earth, father civilization, god of the universe. Manifesting thoughts with my infinite size, making sure this travels 23 million miles. The other tricks are set to crucifix, because the heart of the problem is this.
Big on it, God.
Preacher got my older, putting money in the pan for the rest of the week. Now I'm eating out of soup can. He has a home, driving caddy to town. Has my old earth believing that he's coming from the ground. Slain of those who fought for what was right. Slain of those who fell victim to the bite. A drug controlled substance contained in a vial. Said about a devil as he looks and he smiles. Good at the game of strychnology, but I have knowledge of myself. You're not fooling me. You see, the answer to me is black unity, unification to help all bad situation. I wrote this on a day of wisdom, power, all being born of myself.
God.
I won't diss the next brother to be paid up to my traitors. Since the planet is designed by the colored man. Now I'm made to born to think this is the way of us.
The way of
that's
us.
The way the devil wants it, so it is no fun.
It is no
it's
fun.
Just that sad old song, self-destruction to stop our reproduction. Then put our wisdom before us.
Murderer.
That makes it wisdom, knowledge.
Murderer.
But we need knowledge, wisdom to bring forth the understanding.
Murderer.
Culture freedom.
Murderer.
Power refinement.
Murderer.
Equality God built, destroy, bones our cipher.
Murderer.
Can a devil fool a Muslim?
No, not nowadays, bro.
You mean to say the devil fooled you 400 years ago?
Why equip self for trade and made an interpretation saying that we receive more gold for my labor in his name?
Do we receive more gold?
God, now cipher. Time to drop the bomb and make the devil pay the price for.
True indeed, God, true indeed.
That we can live much better than this. Nothing's changed, it's just another sequel. The devil's still causing trouble amongst the righteous people. Drugs in our community.
That ain't right.
Can't even get a job.
That ain't right.
Poisoning our babies.
That ain't right.
Lying who is God.
That ain't right.
Well, here's a food for thought. Many fought for the sport, and the black man still comes up short. It's time to motivate, build and elevate. Blind, deaf, and dumb, we gotta change their mind state. So I'll dip, dip, dive up. Civilizer 85er. Gotta let them know the devil's a conniver. This is the plan from the brother man from the motherland. Now it's time to take a stand. I'll keep striving to do my duty to awake them to the universal family. I say assalamu alaikum. Enough respect to my brand new being brothers. Buzzing. Lord Jamal, God Allah. Derek X is on the flex. Alamo is good to go. Sincere, the God is in here.
Move on, black man, move on. Move on, black man, move on. Yes, that was Brand Nubian. For all you old school hip hop cats, that was Brand Nubian, Wake Up, the reprise. Oh yes, that was one of the classics. That was oh, so beautiful. I'm Solomon, and welcome to another edition of Your World News, where you are sure to hear information and issues and topics and critical analysis that you will not hear. You will not hear on the mainstream corporate, I guess I've been a little bit redundant, but on the corporate media. I'm not going to call it corporate news because that would be giving them a little bit too much credit. But you're not going to hear it on the MSNBCs, the CNNs, the ABCs, and, of course, not the right-wing, white nationalists, white supremacist Fox News. You're just not going to hear these kind of issues, these kind of stories, this kind of critical analysis from this kind of perspective, this unrepentant perspective coming from two extremely progressive individuals as myself and my co-pilot, Peter Fowler, and you the audience that tunes in. You're part of this show, too. And as we move forward, the call-in number, since you are part of the show as well, the call-in number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. If there's anything that you want to comment about, talk about, ask about, call in. This show is for everybody. It's not the anti-democratic corporate media that some of us continue to genuflect and grovel and suck up to day in and day out. We got to break that a hold. As Brand Nubian says, Pooba said, wake up, wake up. You got to wake up, all right? It's time to wake up. The media has got a too strong a hold on us, and we got to wake up. We got to look towards independent media collectives like this one, like the as well as the likes of Vox Union, the Black Agenda Reports. I could go on and on. The San Francisco Bay View. You know, we gotta build off of those. And for those of us that don't have one of those in your area, you can start one. Start one. You can contact myself or Peter Fowler anytime. If you're on this website, you know how to contact me. If you're on the website listening to the radio show right now, just go to blogtalkradio.com/your world-news. All right? Contact us. You just leave us a message, and we'll work with you in any shape, form, or fashion that we can to help you start some kind of media watchdog or not watchdog, but media collective in your area. So anyways, without further ado, I'd like to introduce once again my co-pilot. Join us live and direct from somewhere within the stolen borders, otherwise known as the United States of America, somewhere parts unknown. Peter Fowler is joining us. Peter, you on?
Right here, brother. Good to be back with you, man. Like you said, what we're going to talk about tonight, what we always talk about, you're not going to find it on ABC, CBS, NBC, FOX. You got to tune in here to WMFW, like Arrested Development. WMFW, we must win. So that's who I like to think of us as, WMFW. So, you know, I want to be able to talk about some of the mythology, man, some of the mythology. Looking forward to getting to that tonight, Brian.
Right. And so I want to start the show off a little bit differently than we usually do. Usually we start the show, and this show is the first part of a 3 or 4 part series that we're going to be doing on the whole mythology, as Peter said, the mythology surrounding many of the concepts that a lot of us, I would say that most Americans, maybe not most of you guys listening right now, maybe you're more critically engaged than the average American, and if you are, then you know that the average American, the vast majority of Americans have been indoctrinated with this mythology surrounding things like life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, justice, you know, all these different things. And they start off at a very young age. You get in front of that flag and you pledge allegiance. You know, I pledge allegiance to the United States of America, blah, 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 indivisible, for which it stands, justice, blah, blah. You know, I mean, you know, that's one of the things that we're going to be talking about. We're going to be delving into the hypocrisies of American democracy, but we're going to make it even more broad, the hypocrisy of America, because if we don't wake up and understand the hypocrisies that lie before us, that are surrounding us, if we don't realize that we're in the matrix, we're in this matrix with these convoluted wires that just dangle in front of us, then it's going to be awfully difficult to manage our way to pick up the scissors and cut and the chainsaw and to cut through those wires and to make a difference, and to because you know we can't have any kind of social revolution with a dumbed down populace. We need a critical mass to create that kind of social revolution that will bring about things like real, true, single payer, universal health care for everybody. For everybody, we don't have that right now. Yes, there are some decent provisions in there that kicked in, you know, such as the student loan provision and the preconditions. But it is by and large something that benefits the corporate health insurance corporations or companies, which are corporations, benefits them far more than it does you or I. First of all, it doesn't even kick in until 2014 in terms of people getting that broken product. But I'm talking about real socialized universal health care, much like the NHS system in the UK, much like what they see in Norway, which much like what you find in Cuba, much like what you find in Venezuela, and on and on and on. So without a social revolution, without people being edified and understanding what they're being robbed of or what they're not getting, there's no way for us to win this battle. And so we have to wake people up one person at a time, one community at a time, one city, one neighborhood, one state at a time. We got to do that, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. We need to rid this planet of injustices. We need to rid this country of police brutality, and we're going to get into all that. So typically I start off with a Black Agenda Report clip, and we'll get into some Black Agenda Report clips. We're not going to start off with one today. I want to actually start off with a piece that I'm going to play, and I'm going to let Peter take it, lead it off on the other end. I think Peter has heard this piece before. It's by an artist who actually is going to be at the University of Maryland, College Park, tomorrow, November 17th, at 7 p.m. at the Niambua Cultural Center on the campus of the University of Maryland. His name is Monty Smith, and he's a spoken word artist, and above and beyond that, he is a social activist, big time. So I want to play this piece, and Peter, I'm going to play it, and then I want you to break it down, and I think that it is the perfect segue into our topic. And so here's Monty Smith ranting like he always does.
Fellow comrades, this poem is entitled The Rant. It is a poem about self-defeat. And with the current economic crisis spinning out of control, I'm seeing more and more self-defeat on the faces of the people I meet, especially people who are poor, hopeless, and broken. Every other word is can't. That's why I can't help but rant. You see, concrete jungle done chipped my teeth and cracked my skull. I know I'm dying. The pain is turning dull. Children, run. Don't end up like me, addicted, empty, and choking on a dead dream. But wait, where will they go? The state is remodeling the ghettos with the flesh of our youth. Even as we speak, thousands of kids are in the street, half dead, confused, and growing cold. The four-year-olds take care of the three-year-olds who watch the two-year-olds who know nothing but screaming and crying. Because even a child can sense when it's dying. Imagine their little hands reaching out to every passerby. Help me, I'm hungry, they cry. But all Uncle Sam can do is pass out more cardboard. I mean, I want more, you want more, we want more. But it's hard to get more when you're hopeless and poor. Just ask the survivors of Katrina. I don't know how much more poor people can take in these Masonic states of Babylonia, where the living dead remain unclear whether to blow their brains out or take their kids out for stolen ice cream. It seems everyone I know is physically, mentally, and financially wrecked by a system of bloodlines. No one wants to connect to the noose tightening around the poor's neck. So pardon me, fellow slaves, when I say fuck being politically correct. There's nothing correct about politics. Never has been, never will be. Religion, race, and economics is what divides us. It is what has guided us into the systematic order of chaos we call reality. Pick up a gun and throw away your salary. The lottery is not going to save you. The nature of the beast is to make you believe everyone hates you. Rearrange yourself and they'll sedate you. Speak out and they'll kill you. Unity is out of the question for poor people. A class war is the only way to get equal, and they know this. That's why they have you focused on punching a clock, so you're not in the street punching cops and screaming, Babylon must be stopped. Know this, brothers and sisters, we are what we are. And no, not all of us want to be rock stars. Some of us want to be rock throwers, hostage takers, and suicide bombers. Now is the time to decide who lives and who dies. Are you ready to ride on those who own the road? Look inside. Are you the one? If so, remember it's not about your pride or your ego. It's about the survival of our people, poor people, hopeless and broken. Every other word is can't. That's why I can't help but rant. You see, I'm tired of seeing the effects of poverty and self-hate. It's easy to see who's ready to die. Just count the forehead lines. The truth lies in the face.
Wow. Peter, take it.
Wow, that is powerful, man. That is powerful. I love Marty's rants, and, you know, I never get tired of hearing his words because he's right on point. You know, and there is so much in that spoken word piece right there. And I want to just highlight a couple things that really stood out to me this time. Every time I hear it, something else stands out. And the one thing that stands out over and over and over again whenever I hear it, I just have the opportunity to add layers of meaning to it is when he refers to the United States as Babylon. You know, and we need to understand that this isn't just some rhetorical flourish, but it is a direct historical correlation to the historical nation of Babylon, and then to metaphorical correlations of other hegemonic societies that have been referred to as Babylon. You know, like ancient Rome was referred to as Babylon because it was a hegemonic domination system, and now the United States is the heir to that system of domination. So we do, in fact, live in modern-day Babylon. You know, people, look it up. You know, look up Babylon as a historical, factual society, and also look up the metaphorical significance of what it means to call this country Babylon. You know, and a couple of things that he refers to, he talks about the economic crisis being out of control, and he refers to poor, hopeless, and broken people. You know, and these are the kind of things that are the reality of living in the United States. These are the kind of things that are not being shown on the nightly news. These are the things that are being pushed to the fringes and out of sight so that they're out of mind. And that's exactly why, as Monty says, people are not crying class war and crying Babylon must be stopped, because these realities are being pushed aside, and we continue to be bombarded with the mythology of America about, you know, all this rhetoric about liberty and justice and freedom for all and God bless America. And instead of looking at the facts on the ground and the reality of living in this country, and he says that we have been wrecked by what? By the system. You know, I love the way that mind forces us to think systemically, looking at these problems. Instead of looking at problems that people face as interpersonal problems, problems with individuals, and of course that's how we're trained to think. That's how we're socialized and indoctrinated to think about everything individually and individualistically, because individualism is one of the cornerstone values of Americanism. So we were trained to think individually, right? And so we think if somebody has a problem, if somebody's unemployed, if somebody doesn't have health care, if somebody can't make ends meet, that it's an individual problem, that they don't manage their money well, that they didn't do well enough in high school, they didn't study the right major in college. Rather than looking at systemically and realize that it is the system that creates the preconditions for the kind of social misery that we're seeing just escalating day by day by day, especially since the economic crises that really go back to the late 1990s, but most acutely being felt since roughly the mid 2007. So, you know, Monty is putting the facts in our faces, you know, and he's saying that the system is the problem. And let me just finish with this, Solomon, that you know, people are not in the streets crying class war. People are not in the streets crying Babylon must be stopped in this country. But if we look globally, if we look at Guadeloupe and we look at France and we look at Greece and we look at a whole host of nations in South America, people are in the streets. People are crying out against the system, whether it be their home country or against global capitalism. Still in this country, we don't have that mass uprising. Part of the reason for that is because we don't have revolutionary theory in this country. Without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement. And so what we saw with the electoral process at the beginning of November is simply symptomatic of how broken the system is. You know, that folks wanted to throw the bums out, and rightly so. You know, Obama and his administration have been disastrous mass of Americans, to working people, and so they want to throw the bums out. But what is their choice? What are the options in this country? To turn to the other party, which is in this case the Republicans, and then even their splinter group, you know, the Tea Party. Alternative, no viable alternative, no revolutionary theory that we put into practice. And it goes back to what you said earlier at the top of the show, because we have a dumbed down society, and the way we've been indoctrinated, we don't have the kind of theory to fall back on that folks in South America do, that folks in Europe do, that folks in other parts of the world do. And I'm talking about anti-capitalistic theory. I'm talking about theories of socialism. That has been thoroughly written out of the public discourse, public education in this country. And, you know, it for a reason. Obviously, the ruling class won't allow and won't permit that kind of revolutionary theory to gain traction. But that's exactly what we need, isn't it? We need an anti-capitalist theory that will allow us to move constructively towards an alternative and a solution to this debacle that is going to benefit working people. So we do need to like Monty Smith says, we need to get out and cry class warfare. You know, we need to get in the streets and cry Babylon must be stopped. But then what, right? We've got to have a theory to put into place once we have the opportunity to do that. So, you know, Monty's right on point, and that's a timeless rant, I hope folks will come back and listen to that again and again and go out and get Monty's material, because, he speaks to the reality of life in America today.
Exactly. And if anyone wants to, get some of his material, he has a book called Don't Shoot the Hostages, a powerful book of poetry and revolutionary theories. Coming from his mind, you can go to streetpoetmontysmith.com. That's streetpoetmontysmith.com, or you can just go to YouTube if you want to hear some more of his stuff. Just go into YouTube and just type in Monty Smith, and you'll have myriad of clips of him performing everywhere from Mangos here in D.C. to the New York in New York City. He's performed, all over, and has gotten acclaim from the likes of Mary Baraka as well as Chuck D. So, definitely tune in. But I totally agree, with what you're saying, Peter. Big surprise there that I agree with what you're saying. But, I guess when people say, oh, you're speaking to the choir. I mean, that's why you have a choir. That's why a choir is important. You know, sometimes people,
Right.
But, this country tries to obfuscate, its populace in terms of what like socialism is and how much more humane a system like socialism is, and so they try to obfuscate and confuse folks by throwing little little terminologies in there, and making, you know, socialism synonymous with individuals, with,
right,
with individuals, right. Anyone from, you know, anywhere from Stalin to you name it, you know, you know, you just go on and on, you know, it, you know, and when people start to identify systems with individuals, I mean, even if the individuals are not as bad, you know, of characters as the likes of like Stalin. I'm not going to try to dress Stalin up as some kind of hero. So even when you know they identify a system with an individual, whether they're bad or somebody less innocuous than Stalin, say a Karl Marx or a Frederick Engels. If you're starting to identify a system, that's really dangerous. I think it's very important to learn what the system is, what it does, how, you know what I'm saying, how it works, what types of benefits, you know, the broader society can get from such a system, you know, pros, cons, all those kind of things. I think it's important to learn about those first before you start to learn about. And the reason I say that is that in the West, that's what a lot of folks do in Western societies is they identify. And you hit it, Peter. You said that it's based on individualism, and,
right.
And so in an individualist society, you base even like systems, broad systems that where certain kinds of people lived sustainably within these systems. Very sustainably within these systems, where it benefited the broader society, where it benefited the land, the nature, the animals, you know what I'm saying, all that kind of stuff. You learn about the individual and not the people that made this kind of system work. And before there was a Frederick Engels, before there was a Karl Marx, there were people that were practicing what we would call today as socialism or even communalism. You look at the indigenous, you know, the indigenous tribes, you know, throughout the Americas. They were practicing communalism for a long, long time, for thousands of years. You know, you look at indigenous groups throughout the continent of Africa. They were practicing what we would call today socialism. You know, long ages before you know the conception, you know, of a Karl Marx or a Frederick Engels, and
that's
so
a good point.
You know, and so in a Western society, you know, someone, you know, and usually it's a white person, you know, can, you know, create something, and then they're given total credit without talking about indigenous populations, you know, that, you know, a lot of times, yes, are of color that lived in a quite different manner than we do today. But you know what? You look at their societies, and they were very prosperous. They were, you know, they lived off the land. They were communal. This whole Hillary Clinton didn't create the saying, it takes a village to raise a child. Now that goes all the way back to antiquity Africa, all right. And these are the types of things that made the societies beautiful. Is that everyone took part in raising, you know, Peter's child or Solomon's child, and so everyone, you know, was uncle or aunt, you know, or brother or sister, you know, those are things that we really need to start taking a longer, harder look. You know, and those are the type of things that they're trying to wipe out of school systems here. The books, you know, we see what's going on in Texas. We see what's going on in Arizona, where you're based, Peter, you know, with the attack on ethnic studies there. You know, these things, the writing is on the wall. They don't want any of this stuff. There is no appreciation for the indigenous populations that occupied Arizona before white folks came in there and swept it away. Because what's so
right.
funny about it is that the whole hypocrisy of this whole damn thing is that we've been taught just, you know what I'm saying, just to imbibe and suck up, you know, words and things that are thrown out. So, like, if you look at even the root of it, but no one's trying to look at the root of it. When you look at even the root of it with the whole controversy over SB 1070, and it's horrible. It's a bigoted piece of legislation heralded by, you know what I'm saying, a very bigoted white woman, you know, that's at the helm of that state. When we look at, if you want to really boil down to it, before white people got there, because when you look at the Spanish people, I mean, the Spanish-speaking people that are there in Arizona that are being targeted, mainly brown-skinned folks, all right, that are being targeted. Many of us refer to them as Latinos. And you look at those people that are in Arizona right now that are being targeted, racially profiled. If you trace back their lineage, they have more stake and claim to that plot of land called Arizona, you know, than any, you know what I'm saying, white woman named Jan Brewer or Mr. Horn, the guy who's on the school board there that is championed the whole ethnic studies thing. They are the only reason they speak Spanish is because their colonizers, their oppressors were Spaniards, were white Spaniards that imposed that language just as they imposed Christianity and Catholicism upon them. That is the only reason why they are speaking Spanish. Because if it wasn't for the imposition of white colonizers, you know, white thugs and thieves that came and plundered and stole that land, they would still be speaking their indigenous language. They would still be speaking their indigenous language, and that's why you see so many indigenous languages throughout North America that are slowly dying off with the elders that are dying and making their transition to the ancestors.
Yeah, you make a good point about language, Solomon. You know, and if we just take a casual look around the world and look at, you know, like you say, you know, folks in the in Mexico and much of South America today, as one example, why people who live in Mexico speak Spanish in the first place. I mean, that's just bizarre. Spanish, you know, that language originated on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. You look at Brazil, the largest country in South America. Their official language is Portuguese, again, a European language that originated on either side of the Atlantic Ocean. Two, Brazil has the most people of African ancestry of any nation outside of the continent of Africa. You know, so you just look at some of these demographics of global population, and it should raise questions in people's minds as to, you know, why are there all these black people in Brazil and they speak Portuguese? These are just obvious contradictions, and if we follow the line of logic through history and we see how these realities came to pass, they all get that traced back to, you know, European colonization, colonialism, the hegemony of these European nations, and, you know, same thing going into Africa with Belgium and France and Portugal, same thing with, you know, the Indian subcontinent being colonized by the British, and even North America. Obviously, we all know our own treacherous history on this continent, or at least we should, you know. But these are things that because Americans aren't socialized or educated to be critical thinkers, we just don't think about them. Because the ugly truth behind them is very unsettling, and it would cause people to question, you know, the rulers of this given society of Babylon. You know, and you mentioned earlier, you know, about the dumbed down masses. You know, and that's not just a notion or a saying. The fact is that the United States society is a dumbed down people. You know, for example, I just recently read some material that said that over 30% of folks polled believe that Obama is either a Muslim or a socialist. Obviously, that's absolute nonsense. Listen, check this out. Half of the new Congress, men and women, you know, the regressives that won office, federal office, back in the election at the beginning of November, half of those individuals do not believe in climate change. Fully half of those newly elected officials simply deny the reality of climate change. Check this. This one absolutely blew my mind. I need to look into this because I have a hard time believing it. 20%, and this goes back to the year 2000 when they were doing some polls on what you know people believed at the turn of the millennium and so forth. 20% of people polled did not believe in heliocentrism. In other words, they believed that the sun revolved around the earth. This is in the year 2000. Another lie that's being perpetrated on Americans is that President Obama has raised taxes for working families. That's an absolute lie. Another lie that's been perpetrated, you know, is the abstinence-only education. You know, and we could go on and on and on about the intentionality of dumbing down America. You know, it's not because Americans are not intelligent people. It's because we are dumbed down on purpose. You know, our curriculums are dumbed down. Amusement and entertainment take the place of education and critical inquiry and critical thinking. And so, you know, a dumbed down people is an easily controlled people, and that's what we're seeing in this country right now. You know, we're seeing that right now. You know, and we should talk a little bit about you know the mythologies, part of that is as we've mentioned repeatedly and at the top of the show again, that has to do with the media in this country, the corporate controlled media, and their role in dumbing down the masses and perpetrating and propagating these lies, these egregious untruths and misinformation, and what we would call, if it were in another country, propaganda. But that's what it is. One example that you know recently in the news, and people are probably familiar with this, is the suspension of MSNBC's Keith Olbermann, the host of Countdown, the most liberal offering of the television shows, which is far from leftist, far from radical, but nevertheless is to the left of the you know the regressive media and most of their news shows, and yet still Keith Olbermann was suspended by MSNBC because he exercised free speech, his right to support political candidates with his own cash. And I'm certain that the only reason he wasn't fired was because of public outrage over that action, and he was eventually reinstated. But nevertheless, MSNBC had the audacity to suspend Keith Olbermann, while other members of the NBC family have contributed to regressive and Republican candidates over the years, and that's a matter of record. You know, I'm not making this stuff up, folks. You know, if you don't believe that, you can go up and do the research yourself. I'm not going to belabor that point right now. But my point here is that that case right there, the case of Keith Olbermann's suspension, is a definitive example of the myth of a liberal media. The media in this country is far, far, far from liberal. Yet and still, the media itself likes to perpetrate that myth in order to discredit anything that is contrary to the ideas of the ruling class. So, first of all, for us to understand the mythologies of Americanism, we've got to be cognizant of the fact that that is one of their chief lies. One of the chief mythologies is the myth of a liberal media. And again, the case of Keith Olbermann is a definitive example. There are multitudinous examples of that, but that's one of the most recent ones, and it demonstrates very clearly the disposition of the corporate media. It's not a liberal media. They don't perpetrate liberal or leftist ideas because they have some dissenting opinion to the hegemonic politics of the ruling class. They're considered, you know, to be dangerously leftist. And so even the term liberal Solomon. We can see that, how, you know, in public discourse today, even the very term liberal is used in disparaging and derisive ways by the media. So, you know, how would a you know, if the media were liberal, would it be calling itself, you know, terms that are derisive and derogatory? You know, hardly, not hardly. You know, that's just utter nonsense. So we need to bear that in mind, that the media is a functionary of the corporate ruling class, and that their ideas are propagated through their mouthpiece, which is, you know, the media in the 21st century. Television, mainline news, even in movies and television shows, their ideas get propagated and repeated and repeated and repeated, and pretty soon people, you know, buy into those, and that becomes their framework for reality. So, you know, that's a good place to start, is understanding that the media, that's why we are where we are, Solomon. You know, why we're on Blog Talk Radio rather than on even Democracy Now. You know, I mean, we don't have a place. I mean, think about it. They went after Olbermann, you know, and he's a liberal, far from a leftist, far, far, far from being a radical. Just imagine, you know, if one of their celebrities actually did support a real leftist, you know, a real socialist, you know, they wouldn't have it. They certainly wouldn't even hire somebody like that. So, you know, the myth of the liberal media, people don't believe it, dismiss it, you know, shoot it down whenever you hear it, call it for what it is. It's a lie. It's a myth.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that if they actually supported a real socialist, you know, a real leftist, you know, what would happen? Because, you know, yeah, that, as you said, you're right. Keith Olbermann is the closest thing, you know, he and Rachel Maddow, and they, you know, then you have like Ed Schultz and what's the other guy now that has a show? His name is Lawrence O'Donnell. You know, they're very much like liberal, but I've seen Keith Olbermann's show before, I do watch it a couple times a week, but I there's no equivocation on my part, you know, who he is and what he is, and he's not a true like leftist or radical progressive, you know. I mean, I've heard the guy referred to Hugo Chavez as a dictator, which is like a freaking joke, because most dictators that I know about, have studied, don't allow their people to vote on referendums on everything from the Constitution to education to healthcare reform. And so, if he was a real like leftist, radical, like true progressive, he would never utter those words, you know, Chavez is the name with a dictator. But that is exactly, you know, when he said that, that's nothing different than what I would expect to hear on Fox News. I mean, I've heard Fox News, their cast of clowns and characters, you know, utter those same words in different ways, you know, many, many times. And people, you're right, people have to understand that the media, It is another way for the state to create public consent, and you know, going all the way back to the days back to 1928, and looking at Ed Bernays, folks, he's known as the father of modern day public relations. He wrote several books, but one of his books, it was like a seminal work, was Propaganda, and that book actually was used by, he didn't write it for the Nazis, but it was used as a playbook almost for the Nazis, because it was such a well-written book in terms of it got into how companies in the U.S. Can use public relations and use propaganda to sell products, everything from toothpaste to bacon to cigarettes. And he was the champion of and there was all these different corporations like Viceroy Cigarettes hired him to create a marketing campaign that would increase their female consumer base, you know, because at the time it was very much of a faux pas, very taboo for women to smoke cigarettes in public, and he created a whole scheme, you know, by using, you know, models, you know, at the Macy's Day Parade, to, you know, walking out there with their fur coats and their cigarettes, and women, you know, they were on the sidelines, saw that, and they were like, oh, wow, that's very glamorous, and I mean, he's one of the guys that you know, the reason why you have like 4 out of 5 doctors say something such,
right? And,
you know,
right.
So he worked for the bacon industry and you know and came up with the whole slogan, you know, 4 out of 5 doctors, you know, or 3 out of 5 doctors say that the start of a healthy day is eating breakfast with bacon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention that's some fried slab of pork, you know, cooked in some, you know, some lard. That wasn't mentioned, but yeah, but people bought it lock, stock, and barrel. I mean, this is Eddie Bernays, man. And so the Nazis used his book Propaganda to learn, you know, methods in terms of how they could get their populace to be dumbed down to follow lock, stock, and barrel what they were doing to gypsies and to people of Jewish faith, Ashkenazi Jews and political dissenters, you know, poets and those kind of folks, you know. So, the media and the use of the media to put forth propaganda that creates public consent can be a very dangerous thing. And I just want to read a quote from that book. Ed Bernays said, in almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind. That is as salient and relevant, you know what I'm saying, as you can get today. And Ed Bernays is not an ally. He's not someone I look up to. But it's important to read the books of folks who have put a lot of time and theory behind the system, that the oppressive system that we live under right now. And you best believe that you need to be media literate in 2010. You need to be media literate in 1970. But you really need to be media literate in the new millennium. You got to be media literate, because if you're not, if you don't know how to deconstruct dominant narratives from yourself all the way down to your kids, then you are sheep for the mental slaughter. You are sheep,
right,
for the slaughter, guaranteed. And you know, so it, you know, we better understand what the media's purpose is, and we better understand that these FCC licenses are doled out to media, you know, conglomerates. You know what I'm saying? Everyone from the Comcast to the Time Warner, you know, to the Viacoms, they are doled out. You know, with money laced to all that, they're a lobbyist, and yes, our tax dollars pay for those licenses that have been doled out. Yes, we pay for those for those licenses that are part of reprehensible stations or networks like Fox News. They pay for the towers and the infrastructure to build affiliates all over the place, but the FCC licenses, your tax dollars go towards paying that. But that's why you see the Obama administration and the FCC commissioner or FCC chairman, Julius Jankowski, right now. I mean, he came in, you know, guns busting, saying, I'm for net neutrality. And if you notice, folks, net neutrality is not being pushed hard by this administration. And net neutrality, If net neutrality falls, if it is something that falls by the wayside, folks, folks like myself, Peter, and many of you that are listening right now, because I don't think we have too many multimillionaires listening to my show right now, but many of you are listening right now, based on the lack of money in your bank account, lack of money in your pocket, you will be put on a very slow internet highway, and net neutrality assures us that everyone has the use of the same speed highway. You might have a slower computer, you know, that has less RAM. You might have, you know, a cable internet as opposed to something like we see on the Verizon. But if net neutrality falls, that means that you and I because we can't pay a whole bunch of money for the super internet highway that's up there, and I'm pointing, you know, to the sky. Those folks will get the fast internet highway, and us, we would get the slow one. And if you go to certain websites, like our website here, or Black Agenda Report, that has a lot of content, it could take literally, you know, 10 to 15 minutes to download certain pages. This is huge. This is huge. And Jenikowski and the Obama administration are fighting this because there's a lot of corporate money that is going in by way of media lobbyists, the Comcast and the AT&Ts, that are spending a lot of money to send lobbyists onto Capitol Hill to make sure that net neutrality slowly dies out and becomes a thing of the past. So with that being said, when I mentioned the word dies out, black men continue to die out in America. America has long waged a war on black men and black people in general. Make no bones about it. Make no bones about it, people that are listening right now. In America, yes, we live in a police state, but to say that some poor white person from the Appalachian has their issues that are tantamount to a poor black person from inner city Detroit or inner city Oakland, you're kidding yourself. That white person can always escape police brutality based on their skin color. Where a person like me, no matter how little or how much money I may or may not have, if I'm crossing the wrong, you know, cop at the wrong or right time, you know what I'm saying? It could be my life. And so it's important for us to understand that this country has been at war and continues to wage a war against black people like no other, maybe followed secondly by those racist cops that we see in Britain. And I want to play this piece, and when we on the other end, we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about this because this falls in line with liberty and the pursuit of happiness. You cannot pursue happiness in America and be a conscious black man. You cannot. There is no happiness right now. I consider myself a very conscious black man, and I do not have complete happiness day in and day out. Why? Because I know the realities of America, because I know there are injustices, and when I see things that happened two Fridays ago in terms of the reprehensible sentencing of 2 years, of a measly 2 years for the 6'7 Johan Messerlies, a white racist police officer in Oakland, California, that executed a black man who was handcuffed face down and shot him in the back. His name was Oscar Grant, a young black man who was a father, and shot him in the back and killed him. That tells you, and he gets 2 years, the same amount of time that Michael Vick got for, you know what I'm saying, for allowing dogfights to be held at his house. Are you kidding me? But this is not a novel thing in America. This has been happening for years now. It has been happening since black folks were brought here in 1619, 1620, but it still goes on today. And so I want to play this clip, and once again, I'll let Peter take it on the other end, because I've got a lot of thoughts on this. I've got a ton of thoughts on this. And if you consider yourself a humanitarian, anyone that's listening right now, I don't care what your damn political stripes are, but if you consider yourself a humanitarian, don't you ever ask yourself why I'm so mad, all right? You might want to ask yourself why you're not so mad, all right? Because when you have innocent people perishing, all right, I dare you to say you wouldn't be mad if that was your son, if that was your son or your brother or your father or your cousin or your uncle who was shot face down on the pavement, handcuffed like a dog, and his murderer got away with 2 years, and he won't even serve anything close to those 2 years. This is Glenn Ford.
The United States criminal justice system has been called the most racist on the planet. And by most measures, that's true. But blacks in Great Britain are also under siege by police, enough to generate a recent visit to London by Reverend Jesse Jackson. A new study shows that blacks in England and Wales are 26 times more likely to be stopped and frisked on the streets than whites, a figure that Reverend Jackson said undermines the moral authority of the United Kingdom. It would be hard to criticize the analysis for sloppiness. It was conducted by the London School of Economics. in collaboration with the Open Society Justice Initiative. On the face of it, the figures would seem to indicate that blacks in England and Wales are targeted by police with even more ferocity than their counterparts in New York City, where a similar stop-and-frisk campaign has scooped up progressively larger numbers of blacks and Latinos in recent years. In England, Section 60 of the 1994 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act was originally promulgated to deal with rowdy soccer hooligans, most of whom are white, but has in recent years turned into a mechanism to disproportionately stop blacks. New York City's stop-and-frisk regime has drastically escalated under billionaire Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who has also dramatically ramped up the pace of gentrification. Strong pressures also exist in England to contain the non-white population. But are the police in England and Wales really more viciously racist than New York City cops? With black Brits 26 times more likely to be stopped than whites, while black New Yorkers are only 9 times more likely, one might conclude that the English cops behave in a more racist manner. But the sheer numbers of stop and frisks in New York City may say otherwise. In 2009, only about 150,000 people were stopped on the streets in all of England and Wales, home to 54 million people. New York City has 8 million residents, less than one-sixth the size of England and Wales. But its cops stopped nearly 600,000 people, 4 times as many, the vast majority of them black and Latino. The conclusion: when English cops stop someone on the street, it is more likely to be a black person than a white, more likely than when New York cops make a stop, 26-1 versus 9-1. But U.S. cops stop a much higher percentage of the people, about 25 times as many per capita. What that would tend to indicate is that a black Brit might think he had it bad in England, but he'd be more likely to get picked up and stopped and searched on the streets of New York because of the sheer volume of stops in the Big Apple. The same applies to prison. The black-white incarceration ratio is worse in Britain than it is in the United States. But the U.S. imprisons 4 times as many people per capita as the Brits do, and holds a full 3% of the black U.S. population behind bars. For blacks in Britain, it's only 1%. So yes, it's true. The U.S. does have the most racist criminal justice system in the world. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Peter, I'll let you lead off with this.
Yeah, you know, we've heard from Glenn with regard to the criminal justice system several times over the course of the year, and we've talked about this over the course of the year, and we need to continue to talk about it because it is such an egregious and an unforgivable tragedy that in this country that purports to be all about freedom and democracy and liberty and justice for all, that we look at the police state measures that dominate society, particularly with regard to the injustice that is grossly disproportionate toward non-white citizens, towards black and brown people in this country. And a few minutes ago, you talked about how important it is, Solomon, for us to go about the business of deconstructing dominant narratives, you know, and this, the Oscar Grant travesty, miscarriage of justice that you mentioned before the clip, is again a definitive case. Like the Keith Olbermann suspension is a definitive example of the myth of a liberal media. The Oscar Grant miscarriage of justice is a definitive example of the racist nature of the so-called justice system in this country. And, you know, we need to look at some of the components of that case. And you mentioned the non-sentence, really, you know, that was handed down to the cop, this Messerly, the non-sentence of about 2 years for voluntary manslaughter, and the judge decided to include time served that he's been in jail leading up to the trial. Mm-hmm. So essentially, he'll probably never see the inside of a prison. He'll probably do his entire time in a city or county jail, which just,
right,
again, further underscores the travesty of this case. And like you mentioned earlier, comparing that to Michael Vick, another sensational case that was in the media because he's a celebrity athlete, and how he was sentenced to roughly 2 years in prison for his participation in illegal dogfighting. So what does that tell you? Just on its face, what does that tell? What's the message that is sent there? That somebody who participates in dogfighting receives a harsher penalty than somebody who murders an African American a citizen. I mean, what does that say? What does that say? It says that the lives of African Americans in this country are worth that of dogs, you know. And these are cases, you know, that demonstrate this, not just notions or wild harebrained ideas. This is reality. And if we look at another celebrity athlete that receives some prison time recently, in the person of Plaxico Burress, he received a harsher sentence than Johan Messerly received. And what did Plaxico Burress do? He accidentally discharged his own firearm and shot himself. So, you know, he received, I don't remember the amount of time, but more time than Johan Messerly got for murdering an unarmed and innocent African American. Plaxico Burress is in prison, or did prison time, for accidentally shooting himself with his own handgun. You know, so you know, where's the justice in that? Again, the mythology of life and liberty and justice for all. It's a myth. It's a lie. It's life and liberty and justice for a very, very select few. You know, for the ruling class, and certainly not for the working class, and most definitely not for people of color in this country. A few things about the trial itself. The trial was removed from its original jurisdiction, and it ends up that the jury was all white. Black jury candidates were systematically dismissed once, you know, the questioning revealed that if they had any dealings with the police or any connection with the prison industrial system. Yet and still, white jurors were accepted onto the jury after even conceding that they had this, you know, this belief that, you know, police officers are honest and truthful and wouldn't do anything wrong. Clearly a bias toward the police, and yet still they were admitted on to what turned out to be an all-white jury. Judge Solomon insisted that race was not going to be allowed to be a factor in the trial. Yet and still, witnesses, eyewitnesses to that murder.
Called him a nigger.
They said, you know, Messerly called Oscar Grant and some of the other young men that were involved in that incident. He repeatedly called them niggers. All right. Yet and still, the judge said, no, I'm not going to allow race to be a factor in this trial. It already was. So in other words, the judge was saying, you know, he was already demonstrating his bias towards the police state and towards the white murderer who took the life of that innocent black man who, like you said, was unarmed and face down on the pavement when he was shot in the back. Now, you know, some people might hear about this case and say, well, how could this happen in America, you know, the land of the free, the home of the brave? Well,
right.
You know, the fact is, Solomon, that this is an example of ethnic cleansing. And this kind of ethnic cleansing has been going on in this nation for over 500 years, since 1492. You know, and we know what 1492 is signifies. And I say mm-hmm. nation going back to 1492. What I mean is the Euro-American Klan Collective, and yeah, it wasn't solidified into a sovereign country until 1776, but that Klan Confederacy that preexisted the geopolitical entity known as the United States of America, it was this clan, this tribe of white supremacists that perpetrated the systematic extermination of the indigenous peoples of the Caribbean islands and of North America, almost to the entire extinction. The actual extinction of a number of different tribes of indigenous people, and for those who were fortunate enough to survive, you know, they've been pushed onto to reservations or open air prisons, essentially. And it's this clan, this Euro-American clan collective, that still is in power and still rules the country with an iron fist and through a police state. And now, you know, it's no longer a matter of debate as to whether or not this clan collective is trying to not only rule this continent but rule the world. So, you know, that's another conversation. But nevertheless, you know, it's a fact of living in America. It's a fact that, you know, the dominant narrative of life, liberty, and justice is a myth. It's a lie that is perpetrated on the American people. And the fact that, you know, some of the things that Glenn Ford mentioned, you know, 3% of all black Americans are in the prison system. You look at the unemployment rates for African Americans in this country. And we look at the fact, and, you know, this is an astounding fact, that 50% of American children will need food stamps at some point during their lifetime. That's astounding enough. But that figure is 90% for African Americans. 90% of African American children born after the year 2000 are going to need the assistance of food stamps at some point while they're children. That's 9 out of 10. 9 out of 10 in this country, the land of the free and all that, yak, yak, yak. So, you know, we need to understand that. We need to understand that, you know, that these narratives, like you said, are myths. We need to understand that per capita income for white Americans is $28,946, almost $29,000 per year for every white working person in this country. While for black Americans, that figure is $16,629, $16,600 and change, you know, as compared to roughly $30,000 for white citizens. So, you know, it's more than a notion, Solomon. You know, this isn't just some liberal rant, you know, as some of the regressive detractors might want to call this discussion. These are facts. These are facts. This is the reality. And, you know, for those people who are courageous enough and have the intellectual integrity to engage the facts and to look at reality, these are the facts, and this is the reality, that the myth of Americanism is largely a lie being perpetrated upon the people. And, you know, folks like you and I, we're the ones who end up suffering. The people who are listening to our show are the ones who end up suffering from it. And so, you know, we've got to critically analyze, critically understand, and critically assimilate the facts, the evidence, and the truth, and then do something about it. You know, I think, you know, at some point before we end tonight, we need to say, okay, so what? So what do we do? What do we do with this information? But, you know, the Oscar Grant case, again, a definitive example of the myth of life, liberty, and justice for all in the United States of America.
Right, right. And also, you look at the research that United for a Fair Economy did. You know, they come out every year with the State of the Dream full report, and you have economists there like Dietrich Mohammed that put a lot of work into breaking down the numbers and looking at it. And you know, I believe in like last year's report, it showed that meanwhile, the medium like wealth of the average like white family was something in terms of median wealth was something like had dropped from like $94,000 to $77,000 for the average like median wealth for the average white family, but for the average black family it had dropped something like 77% all the way down to $2,100. I mean,
right,
it,
right.
That's huge. I mean, $2,100, and that's it's crazy. I mean, that's just if people think that it's because black folks are not pulling themselves up by the bootstraps and this, that, and the other, they're kidding themselves.
Right.
They really are. They're kidding themselves, or they're closet racist, and that they're quite comfortable with that understanding because they don't give a damn about any kind of disproportionality that exists between their community and brown and black communities. And you know what? When you're talking about Johan Nesselies and his accomplices, because there's a couple of the cops that are on the beat with him that are accomplices in murder, and that friggin' vile devil of a judge. You know what? Monty said something in a piece called Hostile, and if there was any kind of justice, this is the justice that would be doled out to those scumbags.
To the white children of prostitutes, addicts, and thieves, you'll more than likely see prison bars than achieve your dreams. For the socially unaware, this means a crash course in learning the extent of the white man's burden. Most whites can't see or feel the untamed effects of white supremacy unless they're thrown in prison. Only there can they truly witness, in pure controlled terror, the reality of being socially outnumbered in hostile territory. For too many blacks and Hispanics in this land of Willie Lynch and Jim Crow, white independence, like a straight razor, has been the weapon responsible for their incarceration scars, some running generations deep. And I mean deep as the dicks taking turns in the new white boy's ass who's getting gang raped for the first time for being the only cracker on trash duty. No, this is not a movie, so cancel the popcorn and salt shaking and pray to God the guard isn't looking the other way while your manhood's being taken. I mean, remember, on the outside, white tradition has led by majority rule, but on the inside, white boy, you're the minority. What you gonna do?
Yeah, thank you for that, Monty. I really appreciate that. Before people jump on me, Monty actually is a white dude, man, from North Carolina. Just to let you guys know that, there are white individuals out there that understand what justice really means, and that is exactly the kind of punishment that needs to be doled out to those kind of characters such as Johan Nesselies. And to go back to my to what I was talking about, Peter, before, when you're looking at, just to break down, I'm kind of looking at some of the numbers right now from United for a Fair Economy and Institute for Policy Studies. 1967, black folks were making 54 cents to every dollar that white folks were making. In 2010, which should be to the surprise of people that don't know this number, it's 62 cents. So it's gone up, a little over a nickel in over 40 years. That's crazy. So, and then we boil it down. We can even get even further in these numbers. Median financial wealth by race, whites, it's actually $36,000. Blacks, $300. That's financial wealth. Financial wealth, if you don't understand the difference between financial wealth and also median and household wealth, definitely go to United for a Fair Economy Institute for Policy Studies, and they can break down and explain those what those terms mean. But median household wealth by race, $118,300 for whites. All right, median household wealth by race. For blacks, $11,800. All right, blacks and Latinos are 2.9 and 2.7 times respectively to live in poverty than whites. Between 1983 and 2004, median black wealth inched up from 7% to 10% of median white wealth. At this rate, listen to this, folks. Listen to this, folks. At this rate, without any progressive government intervention, at this rate, it will take 634 years to reach equality in terms of household wealth. 634 years. So that's I don't know, Peter. I mean, I'm in tune with my own mortality, but I don't think I'll be around to see that. I don't think you will either in terms of our physical bodies. We'll be someplace else looking at that. But let's hope that that's not that it doesn't come down to that. But that's what we're talking about, folks, and that is very, very, very important for you to really delve into the ramifications of those numbers, because poverty, oh yeah, poverty is death. Poverty brings about things like death. It's not just someone just growing up, you know, a hard life, but if you're poor, you don't have, in this country, you don't have health insurance. You don't have access to certain facilities. If you're poor, you don't have, unfortunately, good school systems that are well resourced. Okay, we understand that white public schools in suburban America. I'm not talking about private schools, but white public schools. All right, and we don't have to say white, but we just make the assumption because yeah, you can have some sprinkles of black and browns in there, but public schools and suburban communities. All right. For instance, you look at New York City and Jonathan Kozol's book, Shame of a Nation. He broke down these suburban schools that were just outside the Bronx in Westchester County. And per year, each pupil was getting about $22,000 per pupil per year. Now, in the South Bronx at the same time, you know, we're not comparing private to public, but a public schools in the Bronx, New York, that were predominantly black and brown, those pupils were getting on average per year about $10,000. Okay? $10,000. And so we're not comparing public to private. And here, Peter, here's the other thing about equality. You have these damn blasted Republicans and neocons sitting there saying, you know, Throwing money at the problem is not going to solve the problem. Throwing money at school is not going to solve the problem. It's not going to make it any better. We have to hold teachers accountable. So what right. We're going to do is we're going to wage war on the teachers' unions. We're going to wage war on them. We're going to break them down. We're going to push the whole charter school movement, which is a myth. We're gonna take away tenure for teachers. All these different things. Throwing money at the problem is not throwing money at these schools is not going to improve graduation rates and overall efficacy for these schools. But at the same time, Peter, people listen. At the same time. And this is what I'm trying to drive home to you. At the same time, we've been so damn dumbed down. So we listen to all these top things, and these MFers say this all the damn time. And for the uncritical mind, you sit there and you take it in and say, yeah, you know what? You know what? Yeah, you know, throwing money's not going to solve the problem. You know what? Because you say it enough times, and you have these people saying it enough times. But at the same right. time, Peter, do you think these people, unfortunately, these media literate folks that are a part of the hoi polloi that we're trying to wake up, at the same time, do you think that they realize how full of shit, how full of bloody shit these politicians are when they say that? Because you know what, Peter? They seem to have no problem throwing all kinds of money to send their Johnny and Susie to schools like Phillips Academy and Andover, Massachusetts,
exactly.
about $35,000-$37,000 a year. They have no problem when it comes to their kids. And then on top
right.
of that, you know what? You know what? Under their same rule, let's stop throwing money at the military then, all right?
Oh,
because,
come
hey,
on now.
Throwing money at the military is not going to improve the problem, right? But they have no damn problem throwing tons of money to the tune of $1 trillion a year at the military. They have no problem, Peter, doing that. But meanwhile, we sit there and we soak it up. Oh, yeah, you're right. Oh, man, that's the problem. Yeah, we're overspending on the schools. We need to hold the teachers more accountable. That's the problem. Yeah, yeah. But none of these MFers cares. Most of them don't go to no don't go to no public schools, and the ones that do go to public schools, they don't go to public schools in the hood. They don't go to public schools in governmentally neglected communities. They don't go there. They go to the best schools money can buy, the best schools
right.
that their property taxes can buy, because property taxes play a major role into how much money goes into your school system. But at the same time,
right.
you can have a black and brown family that is busting their ass, working two and three jobs a day, busting their ass to provide for their kids. But because they live in a housing tenement or they live in an apartment, and most of the families in that community live in brick buildings known as apartments or projects, there is no such thing as property tax. There is
right.
no property tax going to their schools. Come on, man.
Exactly. You know, yeah, you're getting at, you know, another major myth that, you know, that we need more than the remainder of this show, and we could do an ongoing series on deconstructing this dominant narrative or this myth, which is the myth of the free market, because that's, you know, that's where this kind of boils, free market ideology, you know. And we had a caller recently who on free market. And you know, this free market ideology, one of the most egregious myths being perpetrated on the American people. You know, the fact is that there is no such thing as the free market. You know, and we need to look at market ideology in its broadest context, and that includes things like the public school system. You know, and it's absolutely outrageous that we hear, you know, the justification for shutting down schools, that, you know, throwing money at the schools is not the problem. But like you said, throwing money at the war on drugs, apparently that's going to solve the problem. When the government itself has come out and said that 40 years of war on drugs have been an utter failure, there has been absolutely no ground gained in curbing, you know, drug trafficking and drug use after 40 years of pouring, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars into this fraudulent war on drugs. Same thing with this war on terror. It's absolutely fraudulent, and yet and still throwing more money at it is apparently a solution for, you know, this threat that was cooked up, you know, this threat of terrorism that was just totally fabricated, and yet and still throwing money at that to the tune of 53 cents for every tax dollar that comes into the federal government goes to the military. Now, how come those same justifications don't apply? Well, it's simple hypocrisy. The math doesn't add up. It's simple hypocrisy, and it underscores the mythology of the free market ideology, you know. And you know, to touch on the some of the statistics that you were mentioning earlier, in terms of the lack of equality and the lack of justice with regard to economics in this country for African Americans, and I forget how many years you said it would take for black families to catch up to white families at the current rate.
634.
634
yeah.
years just to achieve economic
right.
equality. All right, this is in the year 2010, and there's still this chasm of economic inequality between white people and people of color. And so, now, what you said, without government intervention, it will take 634 years to achieve economic equality. And yet and still, what is the reigning ideology of the ruling class? Anti-government, right? We don't want government
right.
to get involved in anything. So what does that mean? We don't want the government to get involved in a situation that's going to take 634 years to achieve equity. You know what that translates into? Is fuck you.
Right. Yeah.
We're not going to help you. We're not interested in helping you. So just fuck you. That's what that translates into. When, you know, this anti-government ideology, that's essentially what that translates into. You know, and the housing debacle, you know, it's common knowledge now, this debacle in the housing industry over the last several years. Tens of millions of Americans
have lost or, you know, are in the process of losing their homes. Mortgage malfeasance has been the industry norm for selling, trading, and foreclosing on mortgages. All the while, you know, the banksters and the financial class grows obscenely wealthy. Now, you know, what's free about that? What's free about
right.
that? You know, in 2009 alone, an additional 37 million people needed food stamps. That's just in 2009 alone. An additional 37 million people needed the help of food stamps. And 40% of those 37 million people, Solomon, were working. They were wage earners. These are not unemployed people. These are not shiftless, lazy welfare queens, you know, the stereotype that gets painted by the regressives in the corporate media. No, these are working people who go to work every day or are trying to find work or work part-time because they can't find a full-time job. 40% of 37 million new food stamp recipients are working people. In other words, even their hard work doesn't allow them to make ends meet. And again, it's not an individual problem. It's a systemic problem. And it's nothing
right.
short, Solomon, of economic violence being perpetrated on
mm-hmm.
on American people, on the American people. That's nothing short of it. You know, when the corporate chicanery finally created a global collapse, and we need to understand that, it's a global collapse. You know, this isn't just isolated to the United States. And governments around the world bailed out big businesses and banks, yet and still they abandoned their citizens. You know, what's free about that? What is free
mm-hmm.
about that? You know, that is just that's a mythology. You know, the rate of exploitation is what has skyrocketed. The rich get richer, the working class gets fucked. And you know what they call this? They call this austerity. And we're seeing this in countries all over the world. We're seeing it in Britain, we're seeing it in France, we've seen it in Greece. Now we're seeing it in the United States. They call it economic austerity.
Right.
Well, you know what that means?
Yeah.
It means fuck you some more. It means we're just gonna fuck you some more. So, you know, the myth of the free market, it's probably the most egregious myth of all, and all the other mythologies hang on that myth. And that's something that we need to continue to deconstruct and to continue to challenge and to break down. And, again, we need to have a revolutionary theory in order to actualize it, so when we do break down that system, we have a system to put in place so that we're not just complaining, but we're offering a solution. And we have that solution. We know what that solution is. So, you know, for you know, in the future, we need to talk about that on this show. We need to break down, you know, the myth of free market ideology even further for our listeners and then get into some strategies and some solutions. We can do that.
Right, and until, you know, folks, until you, you know, and this is not for everybody because I know that we have some listeners that you know, are extremely, you know, socially edified and get it on many, many levels. But and if you do, make sure that you send this link to all your networks so that they can listen to this show and they can understand. I mean, and this is another reason why, you know, MSNBC and CNN are not going to hire Pete and I, because we actually care about the issues. And so, you know, that, you know, the passion that you have, you hear in our voices, it's not stays. I mean, I've had, you know, when Peter was talking, I had a chance to calm down. But I can't talk about these things without becoming extremely ardent about them, because I'm not a paid, you know, radio or media personality, nor is Peter. You know, we're social activists. My legacy is going to be based on a number of things: how good of a father I am. You know what I'm saying? How effective I was in the community in terms of leaving a legacy within the community and doing work there. And I think we all have a role to play in terms of chipping in within our communities and mobilizing and flexing our political prowess, not necessarily just at the ballot box, because if you think that your political expression starts and ends with the ballot box, you're kidding, and you don't do anything else, you're kidding yourself. You're kidding yourself because it's a rigged political system as it is, but and you can't change the political system until you start to flex your political prowess by mobilizing and organizing people within your own community, even to start doing things as like registering as independents or registering as folks that are part of the Green Party, and really pushing for a progressive third party to enter the fray. Until we have some kind of competition and some kind of real checks and balances out there, you know, what you think that you're doing at the vote at the ballot box is basically it's a staged game, and unfortunately you're the player that just doesn't understand that stage. There's other people that are above you that understand that, and so this is what we need to do collectively. All of us, we need to chip in, and these are things that we need to do collectively. Because if you're not, quite frankly, you're a part of the problem. If you don't see it that way, there's something that each of us can do on a small to larger scale. And when you look at other societies that are out there, other societies everywhere from Venezuela to you name it. I mean, you look at Venezuela, for instance. They did an education reform. Close to 2 years ago, maybe it's 2 years ago now, where now no longer are poor kids in that country, no longer are they destined to have nothing to do with higher education except to be janitors or something like that. Now, no matter how poor they are, no matter what barrio they come from, if they make the grade in school, they have the opportunity to go to any school, or pretty much almost any school in Venezuela for free, all the way from preschool all the way to throughout tertiary education. Same thing, you know, in most humane societies, they provide that for children, no matter what their economic, their parents' economic bracket is. But here in the U.S., yeah, as Peter says, it's F-U-C-K, man, you know what I'm saying, to you, and... You know, we're going to push this thing that, you know, this myth that if you work hard enough, you can make it. Yeah, there are some folks that bust their butts and make it. But you know what? For every kid that busts their ass and gets out of some economically impoverished community, there are literally dozens of kids that were their classmates that worked just as hard that did not get out. All right? I'm not talking about the statistics we see in terms of graduation rates. There are a lot of hardworking kids out there that quite frankly, are not going to have the opportunity unless things change to go on to higher education if they choose to, or to go on to a vocational or proprietary school. You know, in a class-based society like we live in, there are a lot of people that bank on and want there to be these huge economic divisions, because when you do, they can continue to pimp people and pay them not a livable wage but a minimum wage, continue to pimp them and to throw them scraps. And education is one of, we talked about police brutality. We've kind of touched on the prison system, you know, looking at U.S. prisons in the most prison populous country in the entire globe. You know, Steven Lindman just did a piece this past week. I believe it was in what publication? I think it was Global Research, and it was talking about the torture in U.S. prisons. There's mass torture going on in U.S. prisons to this day. November 16th, 2010. There's mass torture where you have a lot of prisoners that have died because they have been asphyxiated, because they've been chained and strapped to these inhumane, barbaric, medieval-looking chairs, and have been asphyxiated on their own vomit and, you know, on their own blood by these overzealous, barbaric COs, correctional officers. And this is going on. These are things that are going on today. And so, yes, economics connects to all this. Education, one of the number one indicators of whether someone's going to maybe perhaps turn to a life of crime is literacy rates, or illiteracy rates. You know, we see some states that base their building of prisons and juvenile detention centers based on the third and second graders and first graders that read below grade level. So instead of putting the money in towards programs to bring them up to grade level, they say, okay, we're gonna start to build juvenile detention centers and prisons and jails. Waiting for them, knowing that some of them are going to probably turn to a life of crime because they're going to continue to go on this track and will be illiterate or be functionally illiterate, and there will be little to no options. So they're going to They might turn to burglary to try to make ends meet for themselves, their family, and we're going to build those kind of institutions. And so this whole educational thing, Peter, along the lines of what this country right now is pushing with the whole charter school myth, and we saw the Stanford report that came out last year that showed that the majority of public schools perform at the same level or better than charter schools at like something like a 75% clip, you know what I'm saying? But still we allow ourselves to not do critical analysis when we hear these talking heads that are full of crap, you know, talking about charter schools being better. And then on top of that, charter schools are essentially they're publicly funded, but they're privately run by corporations behind the scenes. And these charter schools, Peter and the rest of us out there, these charter schools, when they talk about all the things that charter schools do, oh, you need creative and teachers, and there's not more creativity in the classroom. Well, you dumbass, you know, these are the same things that can be done in public schools. All right, if you supported public schools as much as you do charter schools, these are things can do be done in public schools, but they don't do them. They don't say them in that vein, Peter, because they want the charter schools because there's private money on the outside. Some of these charter schools are being run by hedge fund managers. All right, and I want to play this little clip, you know, because based on this little propaganda that's being put out there, the Superman. Looking for Superman, searching for Superman, bogus crap that is out there. This documentary that's really pushing, you know, charter schools behind the scenes, you know, and getting a lot of people to you know, just subconsciously, you know, turn their attention to those. I want to play this really quick.
The corporate media, right-wing billionaires like the Walmart family, Bill Gates, and President Obama are all in the same business. They're trying to create a private market in for-profit educational services that can be traded on the stock market and bet on derivatives, but whose costs will be borne by the public. They project this public educational market to be potentially worth trillions of dollars at virtually no risk to finance capital. That's why the hedge funds are now so deep into charter schools. But to transform the public schools into a privately exploitable market requires great volumes of skillful propaganda to convince the public that Wall Street and the hedge funds will save public education. The movie Waiting for Superman is the latest and slickest of this corporate propaganda. It is a profoundly predatory film in character with the predatory finance capitalists that are its biggest boosters. The film shamelessly exploits five Washington, D.C. school kids and their desperate parents seeking to win a lottery placement in a charter school exemplified by a 24-hour public charter boarding facility called the Seed School, where student life is centered around dorms named for a college or university, each housing 12 to 15 kids. There are only 15 students for each teacher. On its face, this truly does seem to be a public educational wonderland. But as mass propaganda for urban charter schools, it is the most cruel and evil bait and switch imaginable. The nation's public schools are in the deepest crisis in memory. It is a money crisis, which has led to the most draconian educational cutbacks in modern times. Teachers have been fired by the tens of thousands, curriculum scaled back to the bone all across the country. Yet this film callously dangles a 24-hour prep school as a real and palpable possibility for the millions of educationally underserved in the inner cities. A live-in prep school is supposed to stand in for charter schools as a whole, despite the fact that more charter schools perform worse than their traditional public school counterparts than those that test better nationwide. Waiting for Superman is a scam and a sham that has been catapulted into the national political conversation by a $2 million marketing grant from the emperor himself, Bill Gates. In the most perverse sense, it is appropriate that Washington, D.C.'s Seed School is featured, since Gates and the hedge fund billionaire parasites consider their cash contributions to charter schools as seed money from which will grow a hybrid publicly funded school system where profiteers will flourish. In the last decade, these finance capitalists have enlisted a cadre of Democratic politicians to wage war against teachers and against the very idea of public education, exploiting the historical grievances of black parents especially. Barack Obama is the highest expression of the success of this privatizing project, so it is no surprise that he endorsed Waiting for Superman as only a president could, hosting the film and the five kids at the White House. But do not be fooled. The film performs the same function for the corporatizing of American education as the movie Exodus did for the founding of Israel. This ain't Roots. Rather, it sets the stage for the uprooting and destruction of public education. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And before you comment on that, Peter, folks, if you want to get a lot of information on what Glenn was talking about, one of the most prolific writers on education in America is Danny Weil, W-E-I-L, and he writes for DailyCensor.com. So you could go to www.DailyCensor, that's S-E-N-S-O-R-E-D.com, DailyCensor.com, and just type in Danny Weil's name. I mean, he's written a ton of things on for-profit colleges like Phoenix University, as well as the charter schools. Have done a lot of investigative reporting, helped us actually, provided us with a great guest that we had, a young brother by the name of Devon, who is based out of Detroit, who's entering his senior year at Frederick Douglass High School, and he's an activist, and he came on our program and provided a real unique perspective on things and insight in terms of what was going on, the attacks on public education in places like Detroit. But Danny has done tremendous work there. But I don't have anything to add beside what Glenn said. I mean, it's right on point. That's what's going on right now. Don't fall for it. Waiting for Superman. We'll leave you searching for Superman. It's a really slick piece of propaganda work. Yeah.
I know this is a sick and truly obscene example of the free market ideology. You know, it's not a free market. It's a fixed market. And this is another definitive example of how the market is being fixed by and for an elite financial class. Okay, this is exactly what's unfolding in front of our eyes. We've seen the mortgage debacle unfold in front of our eyes and over the last 2.5 years. We've seen a number of these financial charades unfold in front of our eyes, and is another seeing the market be fixed in order to what, like Glenn just said, to it's the charter schools is a privately exploitable market. In other words, what the financial class is doing, what the capitalist class is doing, is they are creating a revenue source, another revenue source where there was none. We had in the past public schools, public education, with a mission and an objective of what? Educating American school children. Well, no longer is that the objective. Charter schools have as their objective one thing only: making profit.
Right.
All right, so the goal with the charter school movement is not about education. It's not about teaching and instilling critical thinking in our young people. It's not about enculturation of positive and constructive values in our young people. No, it's about making profit for the financial class, for the financial elite And, you know, in other words, the already rich are just trying to find another way to get even richer. And at what cost, Solomon, at what cost? And in order to accomplish this charter school coup, they have to annihilate public education as we know it. So what they this is the part that we're seeing unfolding in front of our eyes, is we're seeing the drastic cuts in public education. We're seeing, you know, all, you know, the No Child Left Behind nonsense by the Bush Jr. misadministration, and now more of the same by the Obama misadministration. And what these things do is they basically set up public schools to fail, and then they present their alternative in charter schools as the solution. And I'll tell you what, you know, it's an ugly, intransparent propaganda piece, this Waiting for Superman, that they went to the expense and the lengths to you know, film and release, you know, this movie as nothing more than a propaganda piece. Just simply demonstrates, you know, the depravity of the capitalist class, that they're willing to sacrifice an entire generation of American school children while they dismantle the public education system in order to put this charter school system in place so that they can make more money. And that's the bottom line, and we need to understand that. And it's now going to be in the same category as the prison industrial complex, because what we know, that those are being traded on the stock market, and we know that those are privately owned. That people, there's a few people getting extraordinarily wealthy off of incarceration. So, you know, so every time somebody gets locked down in this country, somebody's making a lot of money off of that. You know, every time a public school gets closed and gets failing grades and teachers get fired, you know, that's another casualty of school coup, is the public school teachers. You know, their unions are being obliterated. You know, so it's another excuse to attack working people, another excuse to attack unions, and that's another thing that we don't with the charter school movement, is that these schools are non-union. And so teachers, the working people that make the schools run, you know, have no recourse to unity, to developing unions, to worker solidarity. And so they're being forced to work at whatever wages the corporate class decides they're going to pay them. Like you said, not a living wage, you know, but the minimum wage that they get away with paying them. You know, and this whole nonsense about teacher accountability. You know, we touched on that before about, you know, how teachers need to be held accountable. You know, and that's the mantra from the administration and, you know, and these education so-called czars, is, you know, is teacher accountability. Well, where's the accountability for the Bush administration and their outright lies about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? Who is held accountable for that being, you know, for that turning out to be an absolute fabrication? You know, where's the accountability in the Bush administration for the outing of Valerie Plame? Where's accountability there? Where's the accountability in the financial sector for a total collapse of the financial system in 2007 and 2008, that if it weren't for government bailout of the trillions of dollars, would have caused a catastrophe that would make the Great Depression look like a bump in the road? Where's the accountability there? You know, so again, it's more hypocrisy about accountability on public education, but there's no accountability on Wall Street. There's no accountability on Capitol Hill. There's no accountability in the White House. So again, it's more double talk and it's more hypocrisy. And again, the ultimate value there is a privately exploitable market. It's to increase the rate of exploitation so that the ruling class and the financial elite can generate more wealth for themselves. And if we want to talk about, again, the fraud of the free market and what's going to happen and the end game with this, you know, let's talk about the fact that the 400 wealthiest Americans are worth $1.27 trillion. That's 400 people are worth over $1.2 trillion. That's an obscene amount of money. That's more money than the GDP of the nation of India.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's only 400 individuals. The wealthiest 1% of America are worth $16.8 trillion. That is equal to the amount of wealth owned by the bottom 90% of America. All right? So, you know, just digest those numbers for a minute. The top 1% has as much wealth as the bottom 90%. Where's the equity in that? Where's equality and justice and liberty for all in that equation? It doesn't exist. In other words, it's a myth. And see, they do that through the machinery of things like private schools, charter schools, the privatization of the prison industrial complex. We're seeing the privatization of even war is being privatized. You know, we see these mercenary organizations, and they get, you know, they're extraordinarily profitable enterprises. You know, so that's what we see with capitalism. That is the disaster that is going on. And what's the bottom? What's at the bottom? What's at the bottom is the students who go to these schools in the ghetto, and they don't get an education, and they end up on the streets, and then eventually they end up in prison. And then we have our Oscar Grants and our Sean Bells and the expendable populations. That is the result of capitalism. That is the end result of capitalism, and it's irrefutable. You can't refute it. That is the fact of the matter. It's the reality on the ground that the end result of capitalism is the misery and destruction and the living hell on earth for the masses of people, not just in this country, but globally. You know, even capitalism in the United States has an adverse effect on citizens around the world. You know, we look at how the immigration situation and why we have so many immigrants coming into this country. They need a job because American corporations have basically destroyed the economy of countries all over the world. And so this is, you know, these are examples that are just ongoing and unfolding right in front of our eyes. So, you know, all the more reason to turn off the television, you know, stop worrying about who's playing games with who, and, you know, turn off your soap operas and get up off the sofa and find out what's going on, read about what's going on, and understand and deconstruct things critically, you know, and don't buy the hype. Like you said, Solomon, deconstructing the dominant narratives, you know, critically assimilating the world around us, and then asking the question, you know, what do we do? Where do we go from here?
Right. And in that vein, I want to play this clip before we get off air, because it's a good follow-up to what you just were just talking about.
When you live in a dying system, expect bad things to happen with quickening regularity. We are now in a general crisis of capitalism, which means that so many things are wrong with the system, it's hard to predict where the next disaster will come from. Think of an old, worn-out, beat-up automobile. You don't dare take a long trip in it because something, you don't know what, but something is sure to break down. Even as the robo-signing scandal reveals massive fraud at the heart of the U.S. mortgage system, which could lead to a kind of meltdown, the U.S. Federal Reserve's decision to pump $600 billion into the system could set in motion a chain of events that might knock the dollar from its artificial pedestal as the world's reserve currency. When that happens, the non-military component of U.S. imperialism will crumble. But that's a chance Obama's bankers are willing to take because creating rivers of money for their fellow bankers to play with is what the Federal Reserve does. The banks were already sitting on $1 trillion in cash when Obama's crew decided to create $600 billion more out of thin air. To justify this policy of so-called quantitative easing, the Obama administration is singing the same old tired song. that flooding more money into the banking system will result in the banks making more loans to businesses that will then expand their workforces and reduce unemployment. But of course, none of that has happened because the banks have not loaned the money to U.S. manufacturers. They have hoarded the cash or used it to buy federal debt or spent it in their derivatives casinos or sent it overseas to wreak havoc with developing countries' currencies. All these billions in U.S. dollars thrust into the system by Obama's Treasury and federal bankers, and which do no good for American small businesses and workers, now threaten to create asset bubbles overseas, pushing up prices of land and stock in countries like India and Brazil. In other words, Wall Street is using the oceans of money provided to it by their friends in the Obama administration to export to the developing world the same financial bubbles that ultimately brought down the U.S. economy and created a world financial crisis. The flood of U.S. cash is also designed to have the effect of making the dollar cheaper. The idea here is to make American exports cheaper, which will theoretically create more U.S. jobs. In the real world, the tidal wave of greenbacks threatens to destabilize the planetary financial system. The Americans are viewed as so irresponsible and dangerous to global stability, nations are taking steps to isolate the dollar, to avoid using American currency as much as possible. This is what I call the redlining of America, when nations collectively reject dealings with U.S. companies or even transactions in U.S. dollars in order to insulate themselves from the irresponsibility of U.S. economic rulers. That means the dollar is on the way to losing its position as the world reserve currency. When that happens, all that will be left of the U.S. global empire is guns. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And as I said, Peter, time flies when you're angry. We're unfortunately at the end of our show right now, folks. But, you know, Peter and I just want to let you know that this is only part one of a four-part series on delusions of democracy and the myth of the myth of Americanism. And so we've got much more to follow up on this, and hopefully you'll send this link out and to all your friends and your family and your contacts, and perhaps you'll join us in the dialogue next time on Your World News. You'll call in and give us your comments or questions, and we'll continue to keep it moving and dissecting stuff. So, Peter, I want to thank you again, and I want to allow Monty Smith to take us out with a powerful piece, another powerful piece. Once again, that's kind of redundant because it doesn't seem like Monty puts out much of what is not powerful. And this piece is simply, he's just letting folks know, as Peter and I said, if you ask us why are you mad, you know, why are you guys so angry, we might reply back to you. Not might, we will reply back to you. You need to look in the mirror and ask yourself first, you know, Why aren't you mad? All right. So it may be because you're a millionaire, or the other reason is that you just, you know, you have become systematically dumbed down, and that's why you're not mad. And you need to wake up, splash some mental water on your face, some effervescence, inhale, and wake up. That's step one. Wake up. So for Peter, and for everyone who's listening, and for the rest of the staff of Your World News, I'm Solomon, and we're going to end with Monty. So thanks a lot, Peter.
Thank you, Solomon.
Peace. On Your World. Peace.
It's funny. Every time I'm interviewed, I'm always asked, what makes you write the way you do? Well, I write like I do because John Brown inspired me to, because I'm an abolitionist, because of the no-fly list, because of unjust taxes, because the pigs are still using poor people as target practice, because 9/11 was an inside job, because the School of Americas is still open, therefore Latin America is still open to rob, because the majority of blacks in this penal colony still follow the master's religion, because we're killing ourselves over simple traditions, because James Byrd has been forgotten, because greed is starving our souls, because Babylon is so rotten, because Brandon McClellan's story hasn't been told. I write like I do because the Move 9 needs me to. Because you may be thinking change, but Obama won't free Mumia. Because someone raped and killed Sister Rita. Because AIDS is man-made. Because the CEOs killed Brother Wade. Because hate caved in Emmett Till's head. Because most whites believe racism is dead. Because there's a war against the youth and no one cares. Because Curtis Mayfield died broke in a wheelchair. Because the mark of the beast isn't 666, it's the cross around your neck. Because rap music is under corporate check. Because 160 private prisons are functioning in 26 states. Because our sanity is at stake. Because revolutionary music is under federal attack. Because many of you haven't read the Patriot Act. I write like I do because Peter Tosh told me to. Because Western civilization equals white domination. Because manifest destiny has been replaced by globalization. Because No Child Left Behind is a joke. Because the 60s traded revolution for disco and coke. Because resistance is all I taste. Because what's popular ain't real. It's programming that kills, like believing in religion, money, and race. Because my brother committed suicide. Because there's a digital divide. Because Shaquanda Cotton has been forgotten. Because Unicor is profiting off the poor. Because Babylon is so rotten. Because mentally, mama can't take it anymore. I write like I do because very few are willing to. Because it feels good not to fit in. Because we need more sit-ins, mass rallies, and teach-ins. Because riot police don't wear numbers or names on their uniforms. Because the U.S. has signed over 400 treaties with the Indians and violated every one. Because Bill Hicks is dead and gone. Because when it comes to reparations, it's the same old song. Because no one group can start the people's revolution. Because solidarity is the only solution. Because we live in a world where the darker you are, the more hunted you are. Because I don't like religious nationalism. Fascism is fascism. Because the Coca-Cola and Banadex corps in Colombia are killing union leaders. Because I love my daughter, but it's getting harder to feed her. Because revolution is bloody, and most slaves aren't willing to face it. I write like I do because there's blood in this poetry, and I want you to taste it.